Welcome to the Scripts and Scribes podcast. I'm your host, Kevin Fukunaga. For more great interviews and resources on the craft and business of writing, be sure to check out our companion website, scriptsandscribes.com. But first, we have on the show a TV writer-producer whose credits include The Last Ship, Human Target, and Leverage. His most recent work was on the Vampire Diaries spinoff, Legacies, on the CW, and he was the co-creator of the cult hit series, Jericho. Please enjoy our interview with Josh Scher. Thanks for coming on, Josh.
Thanks for having me.
First off, we like to get to know you a little bit. So I know you're from Northern New Jersey. Can you tell me a little bit about your, how you decided you wanted to make a career in the entertainment industry, and how did you prepare for it?
So I, growing up, I watched a lot of movies and TV, just like everybody else. I think my family was trying to steer me towards a career in law, and. But one day my mom told me that there were people who actually write the movies and TV shows that I loved so much. And I think from that moment on, I kind of knew where I was headed. I ended up going to Wesleyan University in Connecticut. They have a tremendous film program. And that's something I wanted to get involved in right from the start. And so I majored in film there, always knowing that I was headed out here eventually. And I started with an internship that sort of grew out of Wesleyan, and I came out here to really get involved on the film side as a producer. Started as an assistant, worked my way up to executive. I did that for 8 or 9 years before I even started writing. And that was about it. But in terms of prep, it was more about getting involved in the producing side and then finding that, my passions lay in writing, and then I had to figure out how to do that
right
for a living.
And you had mentioned you went to Wesleyan Film School.
Yeah.
Is that something that you would recommend? Is that something that has helped you as a writer and producer? And is that something you would recommend for those, young people out there who are,
sure,
looking towards the future?
It's a great school. The film, it's not really a film school. It's a school with a terrific film major, undergrad
okay.
major. And It's always been fantastic. It's produced a lot of terrific alumni, very successful alumni in both film and TV, and it's a good network. We've always helped each other out. People have helped me out. I've looked to help others out as well. It's a terrific program in that, I still think it rivals that of NYU or USC or UCLA, even though it's 3,000 miles away from here. There was more of a focus on the conceptual than the actual filmmaking in terms of directing or shooting back then. I think it's probably a little more even-handed now.
Right.
But yeah, no question. I would absolutely recommend that to anybody.
Now, how has it, other than, you had mentioned to me that your first job in the industry, you sort of got through a referral from some professor in your film program. What other ways does going to film school, or do you think going to film school helped you in terms of be a better storyteller?
Just having to watch movies that I might never have come across or not at that stage in my life, and studying them and learning about them. I mean, there was something that we had to do at Wesleyan in the film major where the fantastic head of the department, Janine Basinger at the time, she would always put you through the paces and make you and a group of two or three other of your classmates teach the course for the day. And it was, you'd watch the movie that you studied, and that would be 2 hours of it, and then you'd have to get up and give basically an hour presentation on this movie as though you were doing what she does, and she's a genius.
Right.
Absolutely brilliant in terms of both teaching and her understanding of film in general. So it was a lot to live up to, and it was an incredible experience. But, those are the kind of things that would really give you an innate sense of storytelling and concept and conceit and criticism as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, something that you had mentioned before we were on air that I found very interesting and refreshing, and it's something that I like to hear because I think I'm in a similar camp, that there are people who are born with a story specifically to tell, and then there are people who, on the other hand, just enjoy
telling stories and are good at telling stories. And there's a definite difference with you being in the latter camp.
Yes.
Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, you know, it's not something that I knew about when I was growing up, but when I got out here, you know, obviously you're out of college, you're exposed to all kinds of different people, and LA is, you know, it's incredibly diverse, and you end up making friends with people who just had very different experiences growing up and different ways of relating to film and TV, of course. So I found that there's so many people out here who really, they have a story to tell, and when they sit down to write, it pours out of them in a way, and this is not something negative about that approach, but that's how they end up knowing what kind of writer they want to be. They want to work in this genre. They want to work in this format, even, or they, you know, because it's what they grew up loving, whether it's, you know, comic books or something like that. But there's also, you know, there's writers that just, they have that story that they need to tell, and it's bursting out of them. Then there's writers like myself who just grew up. There's certain genres I love. They're disparate, and I want to tell a story in each and every one of them. And it's not going to be the same, you know, it's not going to have that really the same character voice, or it's not going to have the same feel when you watch it or experience it or read it or what have you. It's just something that I feel, well, this is a great story, and I am passionate about telling it, and I want to tell it. It doesn't always seem to be mine. Like, it's coming from my insides and needs to be shared by the world. It's just something that I feel like is a great story.
Right.
Just for instance, I have not lived through a post-apocalyptic nuclear incident.
Right.
That was a story that I felt was, you know, very appropriate for the time, and something that touched a nerve with a lot of different people. And the story that, you know, my co-creators and I had to tell was one very much worth telling. Mm-hmm. And I was incredibly passionate about it.
Right. Speaking of Jericho, we'll get into good stuff Jericho in just a bit. But I think it's important to mention that, because I know a lot of writers who don't have that, you know, a dramatic coming out story, mm-hmm. or, you know, big, huge family loss or traumatic incident, that maybe they don't have that story to tell. So I think it's great that, you mm-hmm. know, you know, talking about you just telling great stories. It doesn't necessarily need to solely be something personal, mm-hmm. But a great story is a great story.
I think, you know, actors will tell you the same thing. I mean, they're not always, they don't want to play the same part over and over again, you know. I'm married to an actress. Maybe her philosophy has seeped into mine a little bit over the years, but the idea is I like to try on different characters, and, you know, we all have that tuning fork in us where we know that there's an emotional connection with a character that you've created, or even a character story that you hear and you're like, oh my God, my heart goes out to that person, or I feel that story, you know. Today happens to be D-Day, and listening to all these incredible stories on NPR and different mm-hmm. podcasts about D-Day, and you know, those stories are just rich in character and history, and they matter. I love telling stories that matter.
Right, absolutely. Now, talking about process, what's your writing process like? Both in terms of writing your own spec stuff, because writers who aren't on staff are always writing, and then writing on staff, you're always writing. Mm-hmm. So you're always writing, but obviously the setting is different, and your schedule, you know, versus your own, versus whatever mm-hmm. show is you're working on. So what is your writing process like, both on staff and not on staff, and how do they differ?
It's an interesting question. When I figure out what my writing process is, I'll let you know. I find that I spend a lot of time, I have young children, put them to bed, spend a little time hanging out with my wife, whether we're watching a TV show or we're just talking or we're with friends. But usually before I go to sleep, I try to figure out what I'm going to do the next day. Because if I wake up the next day and I don't know what I'm going to do,
the day gets away from you sometimes.
Yeah, the day really can get away from
yeah.
you. Because there's a lot of websites on on the internet. There's a lot of different administrative things that you can do to procrastinate. But no, I really do like to know which project I'm going to be working on, what my goal is on that. Sometimes I do wake up in the morning and I put together sort of three goals for the day. Sometimes I wake up on a Monday morning and I'll do three goals for the week. I don't always do that, but every time I have done that, I feel like I get more accomplished. It's just a matter of whether or not I think of it at the start. But, you know, in terms of writing for myself, I always outline. I spend a lot. I was just having this conversation with a writer friend the other day. Sometimes I yearn to just open up Final Draft and start typing dialogue, but usually it's weeks and months of developing a story idea before I can even get that far.
Right.
When you're doing TV, you know, even if you're just writing the pilot on spec, there's weeks of figuring out the world. Where does the show go? What are the arcs of those characters? It's not just where they start and how fun it would be to write this line or write this scene or something like that. The discipline is knowing when you're ready to open a Final Draft on that particular project and you know, start telescript banging, as they say, as somebody says. When you're working on a staff, it's really a matter of trying to gel with the voice of the showrunners and making their life easier and really reading as much as you can of what, you know, what they're going for, asking them questions if they haven't fully articulated their vision or, you know, what they're going for in terms of tone. And then really trying to match it. But, you know, I mean, when you're working on a staff, a lot of time, the time in the room working on the board is golden, and understanding all the different iterations of a story and how this one is more the show you're working on than that one, even if you feel like the ones that get left behind, the cards that get left behind, would make for a great story as well, if they're not learning how to discern between what is a show and what is not a show, is something that I think is your responsibility, and talented writers, you know, ones who are valuable at the end of the day, do that quickly.
Right. And I think it's sort of valuable what you had said about, you know, planning your day before the day begins. You plan, like, to plan your day and week in advance. What other tricks or tips do you have about avoiding procrastination, which I think is the scourge of many a writer?
I hope I'm not saying exactly what another writer might say, but I think having multiple projects in different phases is important, because if there's some days where, like I said, I love to just open up Final Draft and start writing, if I don't have a project that's at that stage,
right,
well, I'm screwed. And right now, I don't have a project that's at that stage. So, but I, you know, having something that is, you know, I'm writing the pitch for one thing, I'm developing a pilot for another thing, I've got there's a book series that I'm involved with at this point, I'm actually just rereading the books before I start writing the pitch and trying to figure out what makes this, you know, what attracted me to it in the first place, and what my through line is for what I want the series to be. You know, having several things in different stages of development is a way to avoid procrastination, because not only do you, you know, finish one thing, take the small win, and then realize, okay, I got to dive into this other thing, there's also, you know, we wake up in different moods, or we read an article that pertains to one project and not another, so now I'm going to dive into that one first thing, and, you know, just sort of having those options.
Right.
One project might never get done, but right, three projects gets done, you know, a lot faster.
Right. My wife came up with something, because she written a couple manuscripts.
Okay.
Saying that she likes to end the day, like, in the middle of a scene that she's excited about. Like,
sure,
you can get to a point where you're excited about a scene and you're, like, not finished with it, but sort of in the middle of it, or,
yep,
somewhere in that process, or just beginning it. then you walk, it sort of forces you to jump right in.
Yes.
If you're excited again.
Yes.
As opposed to you just feel like relief, you just finish the day, and then, well, where do you pick up tomorrow?
It's like right.
climbing the that hill again.
I'm going to flub this, but I feel like that comes from Hemingway.
Oh, maybe.
Where it's, you know, it's really just don't stop writing until you know exactly what you're going to write next.
Right.
Stopping at the end of a chapter is basically admitting I am never going to pick this up again.
Right.
It could be weeks before I write the next sentence. But if you, you know, if your convenient stopping point is actually in the middle of a thought, certainly not even trying to paraphrase what I learned about that from, you know, from his words, it's more the sentiment than anything, but that's the right way to do it.
Mm-hmm. Now, most writers starting out, they struggle, obviously, for a number of years, and many writers struggle after. But many writers struggle before they break into the industry, before they become a quote-unquote real professional writer. At what point did you feel like you finally had made it as a professional screenwriter?
I struggled before I quote-unquote made it. I have struggled after I made it. I've been up and down.
At what point do you feel like, okay, I'm actually a professional?
You know, I'll be honest. The industry being what it is, it's hard to really... I think a select few get to feel the comfort of, you know, I've made it. There's, you know, I'm in the incoming call business, as they would say in the agency side of things. Everybody else is not necessarily working paycheck to paycheck, but they're figuring out, like, what am I going to do next?
Right.
You know, if this one doesn't go, what, you know, how am I going to sustain this career? You know, there's so many talented people out here. There's so many great scripts out here. There's so many great concepts. The world is constantly changing, and having your finger on the pulse, the pulse of a bucking bronco is a hard thing to accomplish all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So in terms of like feeling comfortable that people, you know, I started to feel comfortable when people knew who I was, when you have a credit that people can point to and say, oh, you're the co-creator of Jericho, and I love that show, and you know, and again, because that wasn't the story that, like I said, coming out of here was pouring out of me, some people want to say, oh, you're just a post-apocalyptic adventure thriller writer, and I don't feel that way about myself. I've certainly written on others and helped develop others and consulted on some and you know, et cetera, et cetera. But I've done other things too. I mean, Leverage is nowhere near that universe, and that was one of my favorite jobs and favorite tones to write in. So I feel like in terms of people knowing who you are, you're a known commodity, that's a certain level of having made it. But again, that just means that you're headed towards your next pocket of feeling like you haven't made anything.
Gotcha.
And you just got to push on through and have the confidence in your own ability and rely on representation that you feel comfortable and confident with. It's best if they know what kind of writer you want to be and who you are, rather than just repping you as a known entity. It's a vague answer to a question that really defies, definitive lines.
Right. And speaking about that, about constantly having to, even though you've made it, constantly having to make it again and again and again and proving yourself over and over and over,
sure.
Which, you know, most writers except a select few, if your name isn't J.J. Abrams or Shonda Rhimes.
Exactly.
But many writers struggle with, and this may be the cause or the result of that cause, they struggle with confidence issues after finishing a script. Like, you think the idea is great, you're having a blast writing it, or maybe even a struggle, but you feel great that it's ended, and then you start thinking about it, and oftentimes the confidence seems to wane when you finish that first draft,
mm-hmm.
sometimes even after multiple drafts. How do you, if you do, feel this, which, again, I think a lot of writers, if not most writers, do at some point, but how do you handle those feelings of doubt, you know, when you finished a script, from the high of, you know, seeing your, you know, breathing life into this great idea
sure.
that you had, because otherwise you wouldn't have written it, you wouldn't have, if you didn't think it was a great idea,
mm-hmm.
to is this the worst thing ever? You know, and then get back again.
I think it comes from having a trusted circle of friends who are fans of the genre that you've just written a script in, and getting their opinions first before you widen it out, or mm-hmm. you know, or working with, again, representation and hearing back from them to see what they think, while also going out to your friends and confidants. You know, it can be hard. I mean, there are times where you'll finish a script and you think it's great, and you'll get the word back that it's, you know, you just didn't nail this one, or this one isn't as good as your last, in the words of certain friends or producer friends that you have, and it's crushing. You know, I mean, it can really change or affect your confidence level for a long time, because you're going to write another script and you're going to feel great about it, and oh my God, but what if? It's a problem that never really goes away. I think, again, it's like you have to know what story you wanted to tell. You have to have a good eye to be able to, you know, step outside of your own work and judge it objectively as much as you can. But it always comes back to getting enough responses from people that you trust to know one way or another whether it's good or could still be better.
Right, right. Now, going back to what we were talking about, tips and tricks in terms of procrastination, now what about writer's block in terms of your process? Most writers will face it at some point, although I've had a couple writers tell me it doesn't exist, you're just not trying hard enough, but I think most people face challenges, whether it's procrastination and you deem it writer's block, or genuinely your thought processes, they just don't connect. Do you ever have writer's block? And if so, what are some of your ways of breaking out of it?
I would say that I'm in the camp that doesn't believe in writer's block, mm-hmm. or I should say that I didn't believe in writer's block. But I did go through some personal stuff over the years that I've been writing in this business, that, you know, where you get dealt sort of like a career blow, and, you know, like one of those times where you thought you'd made it, and then, you know, you get sort of beaten back, or somebody's trying to push you out, you know, a door that's not open but slightly ajar, and suddenly you find it shut in your face, and you know, you're looking around being like, what happened? That was probably the moment, and it was a long moment, it was a moment that stretched over a year or two, where I felt for the first time that, oh, maybe writer's block does exist. It was an emotional thing that I was going through, not like a diagnosed issue or something like that. It's just when I sat down to write, I didn't feel like what I was writing mattered. I didn't feel like what I was writing was, you know, lived up to something that I'd written before, or maybe I didn't care enough about it to really push forward, and suddenly you're just going through the motions. And that was the only time in my life or my career where I felt something that, you know, could be considered akin to writer's block. Mm-hmm. And I definitely felt it. I mean, I definitely wrestled with, you know, why isn't it there? What, you know, there's no blood going into it. Where, you know, have I run dry or something like that? Right. And I, you know, there was a voice in my head saying, no, you haven't run dry. You're just, you know, this is a phase. And certainly pulled myself out of it and eventually and found things that I love to do. But again, writer's block is you're pouring everything you have into one project. You got to have more than one project. You got to have more than one passion. You got to have more than one thing to do. And you know, if you only have one project, then go out and see a movie. Go out and, you know, do anything that can inspire you to come up with a second project, so that when you're blocked on one, you're not blocked on the other. And the only way to write yourself out of that is to write.
How did you get out of your funk / writer's block?
I think it was probably, and I couldn't even put a finger on the moment, but it was probably coming up with the next idea that I just loved, mm-hmm. that I just needed to tell. And, you know, sometimes it's, I never want to write for what I think the business wants, but sometimes it's looking at the lay of the land and saying, you know, here's something I've never written before. Maybe I can come up with an idea in that space. And, you know, I've done that, and and loved it. I actually, the first time I tried to do that, I came up with a concept that I loved, and the way that I ended up, I wanted to write it with one tone, and it ended up being so much darker than I was, and that was probably me exercising some demons. And then, you know, I just sort of put that down. It's definitely something I want to rewrite at a certain time, but then I happened onto another idea. In fact, I think two ideas that opened themselves up to me in ways that I immediately sort of got excited about and felt very passionate about writing them. And those are two of the things I'm writing now.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
So. Where do you do most of your writing? Where's your spot?
I drop my daughter off kindergarten, and then I go find a particular coffee shop that I like, and I'll hole up there for about 2 hours to sort of start the day, give myself a bit of a running start, and then really sometimes I'll go home, sometimes I'll go to the Writers Guild. They have a great members lounge. I met a lot of great people over the years there, and it's quiet and they have free Wi-Fi, so it's it's right near my house. So I'll spend a couple of days writing there each week sometimes, and if it's not at an office for a show, and I've certainly been on shows where they didn't actually have writers' offices beyond the writer's room, so the guild came in handy in that way. And yeah, I do like writing in public though, because I feed off a little bit of the energy of the space that I'm writing in.
Right. Do you listen to music when you write? And if so, what's on your go-to playlist?
Oh, what's on my go-to playlist? Wow. I love movie soundtracks, something that evokes a certain feel. I'm not great with lyrics playing in my ear because I'll either start singing along and not particularly absent-mindedly. If it was absent-mindedly, it would be okay. But I actually like get into it and start to lose the thread a little bit. So I really stick with movie soundtracks of anything that people recommend to me. Sometimes, I'll reach out to friends. Some rooms that you're in, it becomes an open topic of conversation. And, I'll just download. I remember listening. I had like 2 years where I just listened to Daft Punk from Tron Legacy incessantly.
Right.
I think that was a dark period for me. But it's incredible. I still love that soundtrack.
Yeah,
absolutely love it.
What's something you know now that you wish you had known when you first started writing?
Wow, there might be a long pause before I answer this question. What's something that I wish I knew now? Look, I mean, like I said, if I like to write in different genres. There are so many people in this business. There are so many scripts. There are so many concepts being pitched. And because this business is so very crowded, I feel in some respects like back then you could write on a few shows before you figured out what kind of writer you were. Mm. And people didn't necessarily, they liked the fact that you'd been hired, they liked the fact that you'd worked and you had experience. Sometimes it was on-set experience, sometimes it was, they just liked that you'd, somebody else had given you the nod before and that was great, and now this is a totally different show, but I think you can make the transition. These days, I don't know. I feel like you have to come out and be a full-fledged, genre writer or a full-fledged, sort of genre writer. Drama writer, mm-hmm. in the This Is Us mold or something along those lines. And going into those early jobs, it really helps you long term if that's who you are and what you know you want to write. And yes, everyone has stories of changing in midstream and catching on again, and that's great. But I just feel like it's easier to break in if you know exactly what you are and what you want to be. And that's a little bit different from when I came in. And again, like if I had stuck to one thing and not taken a little bit of a left turn to do something like Leverage, which I that's more the writer that I, the kind of tone that I want to do, and it's something that I'm always trying to push myself to write because I love it. If I had just stuck with genre, if I had just been grounded sci-fi guy or something like that, like my initial agent wanted me to be,
right.
You know, maybe I'd be in a different spot. It'd be much easier to sell. People would know me from only one genre, and they wouldn't, you know, read different samples in different areas and different genres and wonder, well, who's the real Josh Scher? Did I just speak in the third person? Strike that. That has been something that when I talk to younger writers, I often say, is it's a realization that I feel like I'm just coming around to. Not the, you know, everybody fights against compartmentalization comment, but really the know who you are when you start and look for those opportunities and try to work for those shows. Maybe a bit of a platitude, but that's what I got.
Gotcha. Now, you went to film school, or you studied film at Wesleyan.
Yes.
How did you actually learn the writing process? Is it something you just did on your own? Did you take writing courses? And how many scripts did you write before you had something that was, you know, seen professionally and recognized professionally as, whether it's your writing sample that you're gets you an agent that gets sent out, or whether it's something you sold? So two separate questions.
Sure.
Two-part question.
I had a very unusual track toward writing in this business. Like I said, I was on the film side and producing. I started out as an assistant. I was promoted pretty quickly. I ended up being an executive on the feature side for 8 or 9 years. And only for the last 2 years was I writing a little bit on the side. And, you know, back then I was reading, you know, stacks and stacks of scripts every week. If I wasn't at a breakfast, lunch, or drinks, or, you know, did that executive lifestyle, I was writing maybe an hour or two a week on a Saturday afternoon.
Wow.
And to do that, I read, you know, Sid Field, I read McKee, I read these books, and, you know, I think the school that I went through, aside, you know, after Wesleyan, of course, was probably having read something in the neighborhood of 2,000 feature scripts.
Mm-hmm.
In the time before I, even before I started trying my hand at it, and that's an education in and of itself. Again,
sure.
you're looking at what sells, you're looking at why it sells, you're looking at what makes elements of a story in genre X versus genre Y work, and what the town is saying about it. It might be a little bit more surface than other writers. Approach might be, especially since I wasn't in it at that point in terms of writing. I was still an executive. I was still really just responding mostly to the market and understanding writing through that prism. And then I started writing. You know, Jericho was an early success in my professional writing career, and only then did I start thinking about, like, oh, you know, I should really have like a TV spec sample. And I wrote a Grey's Anatomy. I think it was between the time that Jericho got picked up and for pilot and picked up for series, I started writing TV spec pilots because that was still a much more popular thing back then. Got an agent only after the show was on the air, and I was co-creator of a TV series with a job on the staff.
So you didn't get an agent until after?
I did not get
an
agent until after. So it was an unusual story. Incredible fortune.
Did you have a manager at that time?
I was virtually unrepped. We had lawyers, but we were not repped otherwise.
That's crazy.
And, you know, it was a different time. And,
sure.
And, you know, we were lucky enough to get John Turteltaub interested in the project and then attached. And so there was a mechanism behind the project, but it wasn't our mechanism. It wasn't our managers or agents at the time. And then I signed on with somebody thereafter. So you're not going to hear too many stories like that. And you know, I mean, look, I certainly have not regrets, but definitely things where moments that I feel like, well, I could have gone this way and instead I went this way. I feel like my eyes were a little too big for my stomach in the representation world. Early, I might have done better if I started at a more at a smaller age and work my way up. Or
right.
Whatever.
I hear stories like that all the time. Yeah.
Oh. Every writer is. It's really in every writer's sort of approach to who they are and what they want to be and what their own strengths are. You know,
right.
I came out of a producing background and felt like, well, I know I can write, but I can also work with other writers. And if I were at a major agency and sort of allowed to be set loose in their sandbox, well, I could do great for them and I can do great for myself. And that was folly. I was never really let loose in any kind of sandbox the way I felt like I could have been. And that was a frustration early on.
Other than the actual writing part of being a writer, what's the most important skill that you found for being successful as a television writer?
The most successful, the best skill. God, this is a hard one. Again, you'll be editing this down.
The most important skill.
The most important skill.
Yeah. Other than writing.
I think it's just, it's working with other people. It's being able to, raise a baby with 10 other people. And, you know, you're not going to be able to make every decision yourself. And there are times where you'll feel 100% certain that your idea or your decision is the best one. And that's not going to be the one that ends up being accepted. And you have to be able to deal with that. But that's the ones and zeros of it. I think it's really just in terms of being personable and having the personality that is able to gel well with others. And you're in the writer's room for long hours. You're working on one episode after another. There is an ebb and flow, but a lot of times it just doesn't feel like there's any stop to it whatsoever. And you really have to have the personality that can work well in groups with people of all personalities and different kinds. And, you know, just be a team player. And I think that that's something that has carried me through at a lot of the jobs that I've had. Look, we're all writers. We like working in dark rooms, you know, and not talking to anybody for hours on end, and letting the medium sort of be our voice. But you have to be able to interact and play well with others, and that's an important part of it.
Right, right. And a big distinction between television writing and feature screenwriting.
Sure.
You co-created the CBS series Jericho, which was canceled after two seasons on the air, much to the dismay of your very dedicated fan base. Since cancellation, though, there have been multiple campaigns to both save Jericho at the time and bring back Jericho. I've actually today found a website that's still updated, you know, to bring back Jericho. And two seasons of it have been season 3 and 4 have been in comic book form for IDW. And I heard that there was a season 5 in the works, but it's on hold. And, you know, there are rumors because they're holding it that it's complete, but they're holding it because CBS still wants the property. I don't know. But with all the series being revived these days, like Roseanne and Will and Grace, Full House, I mean, the list goes on and on
sure,
and on.
Sure.
And reboots even, like The Twilight Zone and Charmed, Dynasty, MacGyver, and shows like 90210 doing both. It's like, hey, let's do both. Let's do a reboot. And then, hey, whatever. Let's go back and continue it.
Right.
Would you like Jericho to come back as a TV series? And if so, where would you like to see it go?
That's a very interesting, multifaceted question. I can only say thank you to the fans so much for loving this thing as much as they do and being as passionate as they are and putting so much into trying to revive it for as long as they have. In terms of it coming back, there's always talk about a reboot. I've heard rumors over the last few years, and there's not a lot that I have to say. It's not, I'm not keeping mum for any kind of reason other than I just don't have that much insight about it. But in terms of, you know, where I see it going, we had a 5-year plan when we started, a loose 5-year plan. We had 5 years of what we thought would be story. Some of that got yanked up into the truncated season 2 that was produced, and you know, some of it played out over the season 3 and 4 of the show. But I think if they were going to redo it again, they would probably start from scratch and just do either a straight reboot or a different story in that world. Some of those characters could cross over and be involved, but it wouldn't be a continuation of the story that we told. And I'm not saying that I'd be involved. I'm not saying that anybody from the original series would be involved on the creating and writing side or the acting side. I have no idea what plans are in the works for it. But I can say this from a creative standpoint. When we started that show, when we came up with the idea, I think the notion of a nuclear winter was something that, like I said earlier, like, it touched a nerve. It was something that we were worried about. You know, it was only a small amount of time removed from 9/11. We knew that another terrorist attack was not imminent per se, but being planned without question.
Sure.
And it was very much something that was in the public trough, and there was a very I hate to use the term nationalistic because it's taken on a different meaning, I think, but there was a pride to that story. There was I used to talk about it. This isn't necessarily a show about who dropped the bombs. It's a story about this happened and our flag was still there. And that was, again, like, I'm not, you know, this isn't about God Bless America. This is just, that was a story that touched me, and that was a story that I felt like we could create characters and we could tell an incredible story that that sort of revved that engine. And I thought we did that. Is a small section of our audience still interested in that? Yes. Will it hit on all cylinders the way it did then? I don't know. And that's why, if you're talking about doing a Jericho reboot, there might have to be a different approach, a different sort of guiding principle to it. I haven't spent a lot of time thinking about it, but people come to me a lot with post-apocalyptic, you know, thriller ideas or apocalyptic thriller ideas, and I am at least forced to think about, you know, how does this hit the public eye and ear and tuning fork, and is it, you know, the right story for the time, or not?
Right.
So
now, there's so many series that have come out in the past few years that dealt with the sort of doomsday, post-apocalyptic worlds that you guys did way back when. You know, The Walking Dead, Revolution, 12 Monkeys, Last Man on Earth, even a comedy, The Last Ship, which you've worked on.
Yep.
Do you think Jericho was just sort of ahead of its time?
I think it was ahead of its time. I mean, I don't believe that there were any that the apocalyptic genre really existed for decades before Jericho came along. And since then, you know, there was, I feel like there was some shows that tried to pounce on our audience after we were canceled too soon, and then I think there were shows that, you know, it wasn't like we paved the way for them, but we did create a little bit of a paradigm in TV that now you could frame the likes of a Walking Dead or something like that, and show that there was an audience for it. And that show has just, you know, taken on, gone to incredibly, incredibly new depths and, you know, of character and,
sure,
and humanity and, or lack thereof, and stuff that we weren't ever able to do on a CBS series. But yeah, in terms of starting a trend. There's a little bit of that in Jericho. There's a lot of pride in that for me. And for a little while, it was hard to watch the shows that followed us. But right. I did watch them, and I do watch them, and I love them, and for themselves.
Now, why do you think there's, today especially, there's such a fascination with end-of-the-world stories?
For one thing, I think that TV is not, it doesn't do action that well, but it does suspense very well. Mm. And there's so much suspense in that genre, but there's also incredible stakes, you know, a level of stakes that other conceits don't offer. And when you're watching TV, you want to feel something, and it's going to be within an hour of turning on the show, and to be able to get to those, you know, those incredible stakesy levels, you need to play in a certain genre. And you know, the scope of it is something that, you know, the TV can do, not because you can, you know, do like a splash page from a comic, but in, you know, in the fact that you can show different arenas over different weeks and different times, so you can really build the world in TV as well as any other medium, if not better. And end of the world stories really speak to that, really speak to the world building. When we were doing Jericho, you know, obviously the show was, well, the lights went off. I mean, that was sort of part of the conceit. And I used to sort of like saying that we were using a flashlight, and the only thing that you could really see was in the beam of that flashlight.
Right.
And that was really all you knew of the world wherever we, you know, moved that flashlight around. That was the only thing that you learned about that week. Shows since have gone on to do it different ways. Budgets have increased, ballooned.
Right.
The budget on Last Ship versus the budget on Jericho was, you know, was laughably bigger. So you didn't have to do the, we're just shining a flashlight beam and that's all you'll see. You really could go global. But still, in TV, like the fact that you can move around and do, you know, different stories week to week, show different arenas, and hop back and forth between them, and do real world building, that's why the end of the world genre, you know, seems to be evergreen at this point.
Mm-hmm. What would you do and where would you go if some kind of cataclysmic event were to go down? Because I know you've written for multiple series that deal with that, so you must have thought about it.
Well, not only that, but I commented on Twitter, I don't know, some months ago, that if the co-creator of Jericho and writer on the shows that I've written on were to be caught with his pants down in a survival situation, that would be what goes on my tombstone. So I've taken a lot of precaution in terms of survival and, you know, my earthquake kits. And mm-hmm. I have one in my car. I've hidden one in my wife's car.
You have a go bag?
Yeah, I have a go bag at home, which is more of a hobby than an obsession, to be clear. But it's, you know, I'm consciously constantly aware of certain possibilities. It does bleed into my approach to the genre. You know, I'm working on another post-apocalyptic adventure thriller right now, and I feel like, I mean, if you look on these websites, and you know, they're oh, we're giving you all the provisions that you need for 3 days of survival, but if you go down to the fine print, in terms of like providing food for yourself and your family, they usually talk about it being closer to 10 or 12 days that you'll have to survive on your own before any kind of help can find you, particularly if you live in a big city. And so, you know, in terms of like, this isn't about the government coming after you, like, you know, like certain Second Amendment activists feel. This is about the government not coming for you at
right.
all.
A la Hurricane Katrina kind of thing.
Exactly.
Right.
And that has sort of, you know, obviously it's interesting to imagine, terrifying to imagine, of course, but it works because I write for a living and write in that genre, but I also, you know, in terms of like, what am I going to do with my family camping gear? You know, I have water straws.
Okay.
The water filtration straws.
I know what they are.
Among many other things, but I also have little kids. So I have to take into consideration, not that it's important for this particular podcast, but I have to take into consideration that my one-year-old can't drink through a straw.
Gotcha.
So I've got to provide clean water for him because in a different way, because he's one. I doubt that my 5.5-year-old would be able to really do it for very long either. So I have to take those precautions as well. But I've read more than I want to. I know more than I want to on this particular topic. But you know, apocalypse, come at me.
So while the likelihood of an apocalypse hitting us in the very near future is probably very small, hopefully. If you were a betting man, which I don't know if you are or not, but if you were a betting man and had to pick the way in which it would strike us, nuclear winter or or famine, disease, aliens, what would you, or an asteroid, what would you say is the most likely?
I think we got into the weeds on Last Ship with bioterror.
Yeah.
And the ability to create some kind of a virus or a flu that could be devastating with not a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
And not much manpower. I feel like our government must be all over that. I'm sure that they are, but I feel like that's a place where, given that, you know, we're in this sort of ISIS-driven lone wolf kind of attack sort of moment, I feel like the most likely way that we're going to meet with some kind of cataclysm or apocalyptic scenario, and I'm again hoping it never happens, but
right.
it's got to be in the viral flu arena.
Sure.
There's just it's hard to completely oversee that space,
right?
And there's dark corners in the world.
Yeah. WGATA Packaging and Conflict of Interest Standoff, which is going around. Just quickly, what's your take on it, and how has it affected you personally?
My take on it is I am a true blue supporter of the WGA. I stand with them completely on this. I've been involved in a lot of the actions that they've taken over the last few weeks and months. I go to the mixers, the meetings. I do everything I can to be a part of this movement because I really do believe in it with regard to packaging and with regard to the producing entities being under the agency umbrellas. But in terms of the way it's hit me, you know, I consider myself a mid-level writer when it comes to staffing on other people's shows, which is something that I've done and I enjoy doing. And mid-level jobs have dried up in a big way over the last 4 or 5 years.
Like the middle class of America.
Just like the middle class of America,
right.
Of course. But you know, mid-level writers are really important in the writing ecosystem for a lot of reasons. And, you know, showrunners rely on having as many experienced people in a room as they can. And when you're having rooms that are, you know, 6 and 7 people, or even if you have a room that's, you know, that's 10 or 12 different slots, a lot of times they don't seem to have the money to hire the mid-level writers that they would really benefit from having. The fact that there's fewer and fewer mid-level writers being hired on staffs, I feel like is a direct result of the packaging money that comes out of a show's budget.
Gotcha.
I could see you were wondering where I was going with that long-winded answer.
It came right back around.
But that's that's one way, and it's the way that's impacted my career the most. Because that 3% of the budget that comes out off the top for the agencies, I'm not naive enough to think that all of that money would go right into the writer's budget, but you only need a fraction of it to go into the writer's budget to pay for two of me.
Right.
And so that,
and that's on every show.
And that's on every right. show, and we're at peak TV. So there'd be a lot more jobs. I think showrunners would benefit from it because they'd spend less time rewriting, or they'd be able to delegate to experienced TV writers with, you know, more responsibility. I also think that younger writers, you know, emerging writers and first and second time staff writers would benefit from it because they'd have more people to learn from. They'd have more, they'd have less expectation on them immediately right out of the gate, and they'd have more time to learn the trade and learn the you know, the ups and downs of TV writing life. And I just think that a little bit of extra money in that writer budget would go a very long way. And that's not just a personal appeal, but it is something that I found has really impacted me. And I feel like I'm making a somewhat legitimate connection to the struggles that we're having right now with the, you know, with this conflict.
Right. Did you know there's another Josh Scher out there who created the Canadian-based fast casual restaurant Freshie? Did you know that?
I had no idea.
Yeah.
Same spelling?
Yeah.
Yeah, I feel like I should go eat there the next time I'm
you should.
In Canada and hungry.
Well, no, there's a bunch in Los Angeles.
Oh, really?
It's a chain. There's like 600 or 700 of them around the world. Yeah.
Make sure I have his information.
Yeah.
I'd love to look him up.
Yeah. I guess, and lastly, do you have any advice for these emerging writers out there, or is there anything else that you wanted to share?
Yeah, I mean, I think I talked about it earlier. You know, make sure that as clearly as you can, understand what kind of writer you want to be, and try like hell to start in, you know, as close to that as possible in terms of what show you're working on, or what movie that you're working on, or you know, be as close to the genre that you write as you can be. It's just the easiest way to brand yourself and identify yourself for future employers, and the quickest way to make great contacts in that world, rather than having to, you know, spend 3 or 4 years working in one area and then try to break into another. Because we're all, you know, a showrunner only has so much time to read, and, you know, they need to know that you're their guy as quickly as possible. And then, of course, there's just, you know, every contact that you make can work their way up to the next level and ultimately hire you. It's just it's beneficial for you in so many ways if you figure out exactly who you want to be when you start and go after that guns blazing. You know, I there's something that's going on right now with the ATA situation that has been incredible, and that's the writer mixers and writers helping other writers on Twitter. I've been the beneficiary of some of that. I've tried to help out where I could as well. I go to a lot of the mixers. I try to be as social as I can be in those scenarios. It's something I really wish that we were doing as a guild years ago.
Right.
I wish that it had started a long time ago, because we'd all be better off if it did. And I think that any young writer would benefit from, you know, from getting in on the ground floor of all that now, and just being a part of it. And long after this ATA situation goes away, they should continue it, because it will only help them, and then they can help others, and you know, our lives will be a little bit different because of it, and maybe we'll have to take an hour or two away from writing each week that we wouldn't have ordinarily done, but that might be good for us as well.
Right.
But it's definitely going to help writer solidarity and you know, in the lives of writers for a long time to come.
Well, that's it. Thanks for coming on the show, Josh. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you very much for having me. This was a pleasure. And yeah,
be sure to follow Josh Scher on Twitter. It's at Bring Back Jericho. No, I'm just kidding. It's Josh Scher 1. That's Joshua Scher. Excuse me. At Joshua Scher 1. That's Joshua, like it sounds, Scher, the numeral 1. So check him out on Twitter. And if you have questions about the craft or business of writing, you can send us an email to ask@scriptsandscribes.com or send us a tweet to @scriptscribes. There's no and in the middle there, just @scriptscribes. And thank you all for listening.